Hi, listeners, and welcome to Reasonable and Necessary. We're Australia's premier podcast series on everything you ever wanted to know related to the National Disability Insurance Scheme. I'm your host, Dr. George Talaporos, and today we're talking about the NDIS and transport. If you want to know how the NDIS can fund your transport needs, please stay tuned. We will also delve into recent case law so we can see what has happened when participants have challenged NDIS transport funding decisions. With me today is Chris Thwaites, Legal Advocacy Lead at the Summer Foundation. How are you, Chris?
I'm great, George. How are you?
I'm pretty well, thank you.
G'day, listeners.
So today we're going to talk about NDIS and transport, and I understand that's one of your favourite topics.
It is. It's complex. It's really started to make the agency think about how the Act works. Transport pretty well influences or has an impact on lots of people. Lots of people have to travel to get to services. It's a pretty standard thing to require about people moving around in the community. So I think it affects a lot of people.
And also I think that it's one of those issues that has for a long time been debated as something that people should have a right to. And for a long time, people with disabilities have had a hell of a lot of issues when it comes to transport. So we're all looking at the NDIS as a way of solving it.
Absolutely. And look, in modern society, participation nearly always goes with the ability to travel or move around, because that's what participation is about in the community a lot of cases.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's start maybe with looking at some of the information that the NDIS provides about how it will fund transport. And there are a couple of fact sheets that are available. Well, there's one fact sheet that's available in various formats that people can check out, and it's a pretty straightforward piece of communication, and it says that a participant will generally be able to access funding through the NDIS for transport assistance if the participant cannot use public transport without substantial difficulty due to their disability. What does that mean in terms of substantial difficulty?
Well, you know, that's a case for case-by-case basis, but that tends to be the gateway in relation to getting funding. It's about whether you can use transport without substantial difficulty in relation to public transport. So it's about whether you can get onto public transport, get onto trains, get onto buses.
And do you think that is something that could be easily proven, or could it be in some way a little bit borderline or debatable?
Well, there is a bit of a grey area, I suppose, around super stops and being able to get onto some forms of public transport in some areas in relation, whereas opposed to other areas it's less accessible because of the nature of the environment that's built around the public transport. But a lot of issues around this could easily be supported by some of the specialty reports that you have supporting any sort of application to the NDIS or the NDIA, I should say.
And it's interesting because when the NDIS was introduced, it meant that once you receive a plan, and your plan is activated, you will lose the mobility allowance. And mobility allowance has the same requirement. So it says that you must have substantial difficulty to use public transport. So I guess it's partly trying to align the former funding subsidy that was the mobility allowance with what is now a funded support in someone's package.
Yeah, and that that links with the no disadvantage test as well. You should be able to move, in theory, seamlessly from state-based funding to the NDIA funding.
All right, and the second part of the fact sheet said that funding takes into account any relevant taxi subsidy scheme. It does not cover transport assistance for carers. to transport their family member with a disability for everyday commitment. Oh, that's a bit controversial.
Yeah, I think it is controversial. Again,
the last part.
That last part around whether it will not cover transport assistance for carers to transport their family members with a disability for everyday commitments. And that comes back to some of the things that we've talked about before in relation to reasonable and necessary and what everyday commitments are and how that works together. And reasonable and necessary, as we've talked before, has to be directly linked to the disability and the goals in people's plans and not everyday activities. And maybe that's where that links.
And maybe an example could be that, you know, if you have a child, parents will generally take their child to swimming lessons. They wouldn't expect the government to pay for that travel. So if you have a disability, parents would in some way have the same responsibilities.
Yeah, and that's what the Act and the rules are trying to get at, really, about what's reasonable to expect family supports and community supports to provide. And they won't fund those sort of things. It's going to be things over and above that, specifically related to a person's disability.
Yeah, and I just think we need to keep that in mind when they're looking at their own circumstances. So if you're an adult versus a child, you'd have, I guess, greater expectations around the transport supports that you could expect.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's supposed to be a case-by-case basis, so it'll look at your current circumstances and your environment around that. But definitely moving into adulthood and moving into independent living has a different sort of aspect to those sort of things.
Mm. Okay, the other thing that people could learn from the fact sheet is that there's the NDIS is effectively defined at three levels of transport support, and these levels range from $1,606 a year to $3,456 a year at level three. And the way they've sort of differentiated it has been really around whether or not they're in employment.
Yeah, it's an interesting piece of work, this fact sheet. It does provide three levels or outlines three levels of funding. And as you read it, it seems to have the lowest level of funding for people who are not working or studying and attending day programs, but are seeking to enhance their community access. So I assume it's the enhance the community access that attracts the lower level of funding rather than having to travel for your work or study as well.
And I'm thinking that $1,600 a year, that's not going to get you very far, is it?
Well, depending on where you live as well, it's not going to get you many trips at all, is
well,
it?
Well, you know, it's a taxi, $50, you know, to get anywhere, really. We know that Uber's not terribly accessible. You're not really left with a lot there.
Yeah, so that's what I find one of them. A number of things I find odd about this fact sheet is it's not really, it doesn't take into the nuance of where people might be living and how far they might have to travel in relation to even get to the basics of seeking to enhance community participation and access.
It does look like a very blunt instrument, doesn't it?
It looks like a very blunt instrument.
But like all blunt instruments, there's a nice little bit at the end that says that there are some participants who would receive higher funding, if either general or funded supports in their plan are there to enable their participation in employment. So they're really shutting the door to anyone who's not currently in employment, and they're saying that's basically all you're going to get unless you have a job.
Yeah, employment seems to be the big thing in this fact sheet. It seems to be what they attach the type of funding to, and even for exceptional circumstances, what they attach the type of funding to. It's interesting, some of the previous versions of this fact sheet had a limit on even what exceptional circumstances would go up to. A couple of years ago, it said it would take a limit up to $6,000. They seem to have dropped that for some reason.
All right, well, now that we've sort of looked at what the NDIS has provided and the three levels. Let's talk a bit about how these funding applications have been challenged in case law. Now, I understand that there's one particular case that you're particularly fascinated by, Chris, and that's the McGarrigle case.
Yeah, that's right, George. So the McGarrigle case came down last year as a single judge of the federal court. So the background to this case was that Liam McGarrigle, who lives about, as far as I remember, about 25 or 30 kilometres outside Geelong, he was a participant in the NDIS, and his first plan paid for the transport costs for him to get to his work and to a group program over the week. His second
plan... And how high was the funding for the first plan? I remember reading it was quite substantial. It was
substantial, especially in light of that fact sheet that we...
Yeah, I think it was around the 14,000.
Yeah, eventually it was. So it started around the 10,000 mark. Okay. The second plan was up because of the nature of just increasing transport costs, was up around the $12,000 or $13,000 mark, and then the final one was up around the just over $15,000. So he got full funding for the first two plans for all of his transport costs in relation to that, and then when he came to his third plan, the agency decided, while these are the costs for the transport that we paid for before, we're only going to pay 50.8% was the initial decision.
50.8%
of those.
I wonder how that came to the 0.8.
It seems to be a bit of a mystery. No one can quite work out how it got to 50.8. So what happened was they asked for an internal review of that decision. And the internal review came back and said that it's not reasonable to ask for his family to pick up that extra amount. So they'll up the amount that they will cover, and they ended up covering 75% of the full costs.
And that was through the appeals process?
That was the appeals, that was an internal review. So the initial decision was for the 50.8%, and then the internal review upped that to 75% of the total cost.
Okay. And they weren't happy with that, were they?
They were not happy with that. And you can understand why.
When I say they, I mean the family.
The family. Yeah. So you can understand why. In the previous plans, they'd been fully funded for these transport costs. And suddenly, in the third plan, it started to get a percentage of it, even though the costs had been going up. So they took the matter to the Administrative Appeals Tribunal. Legal Aid helped them with that and helped represent them with that. And the Administrative Appeals Tribunal looked at that decision. So they're now looking at the decision to say, we'll fund 75% of what is acknowledged as the total cost. And so the tribunal looked at that and they said, no, we think that's about right. 75% taking into account the circumstances of the family around Liam. And so the tribunal decided that 75% was about right as well.
Okay, so they probably would have felt a bit deflated by that, but they weren't going to be beaten, were they? They went one step higher.
They weren't going to be beaten. They took the matter to the federal court. And again, Legal Aid was involved in that matter. And that matter was heard in front of Justice Mortimer, a single judge of the federal court. And in March 2017, she handed down her decision. So, interesting decision. It's on the federal court website. And she basically said...
Can I just say something around that? I remember when that case was first announced, and there was so much excitement in the advocacy world, because that was a really... I hate the word brave, but let me just use it. It was pretty brave to take it all the way to the High Court. The federal court. And then to get that outcome, saying to the NDIS, that they were wrong.
Yep.
It was pretty exciting amongst us advocates.
Absolutely. And it shows the efficacy of going through the appeals process. But you also got to recognise that that's hard work. You're pushing it all the way up. So good on the people who really pushed this as far as they could up there to get the right sort of decision. But that's how the appeals processes work. And in this regard, the McGarrigles got the decision that they wanted, which was great because it set a precedent on how transport should be approached, the issue of transport should be approached.
And this would have... we'll talk a bit about the details of the decision by Mortimer, but this would have really freaked out the NDIA a bit, do you think, in terms of saying to them, hang on a minute?
Yeah, I think, you know, around transport and the costs of transport, people always start to think about how the costs are going to build up and how it's going to be afforded and how the NDIA budget's going to be affected by transport decisions across the board for people because they're not insubstantial sums. So I think there's always that sort of concern about how these costs are going to be covered or whether that's going to blow the budget out.
That's right. So let's talk a bit about the decision. We'll get a bit legalistic now and give us the guts of what the decision made says for people with respect to their funding.
My favourite thing's getting legalistic, George.
I know it is. You're very excited.
I get very excited about these sort of things. But basically the decision looks at how you read the Act, specifically one of my favourite sections of the Act, which we've talked about before, which is Section 34, and how that's approached, especially when you're looking at transport. So it talks about how you approach decision-making around what is reasonable and necessary, and whether you look, and it's a good decision because there are good arguments on both sides about whether you, one, look at what is reasonable and necessary and how that should be funded, or whether you look at something being reasonable and necessary without taking into account the funding capacity of those people and whether that should be a percentage in relation to the funding that's provided for reasonable and necessary support. So that sounds a bit complicated, but basically it's about how the section is drafted, and it talks about funded supports. And so Justice Mortimer looked at the wording of the section and said, well, you have to have a look at all those things that we've talked about before in relation to Section 34 about what is a reasonable and necessary support. But once you come to the conclusion that it's a reasonable and necessary support, then that's your job done. That's what's done. That's what needs to be funded, because the top of the section says funded.
Just get under it.
The department in its arguments said no, because part of the consideration of reasonable and necessary is what parents and the community can provide, and so you've got to take that into consideration, and that's how you can say it's a reasonable and necessary support, but the community or the family can provide some of that, so you don't have to fully fund it.
So you've got two opposing arguments.
Two opposing arguments.
And in this case, it landed in favour of the McGarrigle family. Can you just maybe help us understand how do you think that went in their direction as opposed to the reasonable and necessary argument put forward by... Because in some way I can see that both arguments do have merit in terms of saying that, you know, the family could be seen as having some capacity. But how old is Liam? I think he's...
20.
Yeah, I didn't think he was 20. So I don't know, but I think that for an ordinary family, it would be not necessarily expected that mum and dad would drive around their 20-something-year-old son, and that it would be entirely appropriate for them to say, hang on, that's not our responsibility anymore.
Yeah, that's true. And some of the arguments that were run extrapolated that, saying, well, you know, if you can say a support is a reasonable and necessary support, but qualify that by saying but somebody else has to pay for part of that support, then in a way you're introducing a means test by the back door. We all know that the NDIS and the NDIA is means tested. But if you're saying, well, you can get these supports, but somebody has to be able to afford to pay for some of them, then it is a way of introducing a sort of means test from them.
Yes, and I read that in the case, and it said that we need to not think about what the family could afford, because the whole idea is that it's not about putting the cost onto the person or the family.
And that really, you know, if you extrapolate that, and this is what the judge thought about, if you extrapolate going down that way of making these decisions, you expose a participant to the vagaries of what their family might decide they want to do for them. So they might miss out on the support altogether if the family just decides, well, we're not going to participate, we're not going to put in any funding for this, or we're not going to drive you anywhere. And so they might miss out on the support entirely, depending on what the family's approach to it is. And I think that was also one of the things that helped drive the other argument, that it shouldn't be at the capacity or the whimsy of other types of support in order to get these supports that have already been deemed to be reasonable and necessary.
Okay, so it landed on the side of the family and person with a disability. Can we then think about what are the consequences, or the effectively, what does this say for other people who might be listening, who might think that they didn't get all the funding that they were entitled to? I'm sure there were some implications here.
Yeah, well, just to follow up, the department appealed, and that appeal went to the full court of the federal court, which is three judges, and they heard that in August this year and dismissed the appeal and sent it back to the AAT. So they have indicated that they think the decision was correct as to law, and so the McGarrigle matter is now back at the AAT, and the appeals court has suggested that it should be heard by a three-member panel at the AAT, including the president. So that decision is still at the AAT.
That's really interesting. So does that mean that they won again? In terms of the family, it feels like?
Yeah, generally speaking. So the appeal grounds that were put to the full federal court were dismissed. So the full federal court said, no, you don't have the, you know, we don't think that these appeal grounds are going to be successful, so we're not going to hear the appeal, and the matter goes back to the AAT to decide as to law, because the current decision made by, remember, there was two decisions made by the agency. One was fund but at a 50.8% amount, and then they did the 75% on internal review. Now that decision is again in front of the AAT, with the federal court's decision, Justice Mortimer's decision saying, no, this is the way you have to do it, and so you need to have another look at that and do it accordingly.
Why didn't the full bench of the federal court just uphold it and the matter was done? Like, it feels like we're in a circle of lawyer heaven, but participant and agency hell, really. It feels like it's not really working if it's now going back to be heard at the AAT.
Well, it might sound like it's not really working, but that's the nature of the appeals process. That's how they do it. So the federal court will say, this is what the law is and this is how it should be applied. They will rarely then say, therefore, this is what the decision is. They will say, the decision maker underneath us either got the law wrong or applied it wrong. You've got to go back and do it properly.
Wow. And then what?
And so then there'll be a decision of the AAT. So I haven't been able to find out when that will be, but this matter is now back at the AAT, and there'll be a decision of the AAT, and whether the McGarrigles get the decision that they want or they don't, then they get an option to pursue that further.
And when does it go to the High Court?
Well, the High Court's at the top of that tree. So let's start from the agency. There's the original decision in the agency, And then there's the review, the internal review of the agency. And then there's the AAT. And then there's the federal court, usually a single judge of the federal court. And then there's the full federal court, which is a number of judges sitting on it. And then there's the high court. So there's a whole raft of levels.
And why didn't it go from the full, from the federal court to the high court?
Well, because the party that appealed, which was the agency, was told your appeal grounds, we're not going to entertain your appeal grounds, oh, okay. So sent it back. So they're now all back at the AAT. So I know that sounds like lawyer heaven and doesn't get us very far in relation to people on the ground and getting decisions made. But the agency will be taking notice of Justice Mortimer's decision. The agency will be looking at the decision reasons and saying, okay, well, this is the way we have to apply it.
Can we just step back then? Because that's a pretty long process that the family has gone through. Do you think that there'll be a lot of people listening that will think, oh, wow, that's too much for me? Like, it feels like the NDIA has won because there's still all this work that's gone into it and yet there's still no outcome for the person and their family.
Yeah, look, there's no getting away from how exhausting the appeals processes can be. But these headline cases, so this is a relatively new act and a new agency and how they're supposed to apply the law. And so these headline cases, these new cases that are really setting down what the courts are saying, what the law is and how it should be applied, are the ones that are going to take some time to figure out and through. But once they've settled, once the appeal process is settled and the law is settled, then how that is applied goes back to the agency and they will start applying the law as it's been set out by the way the court said it should be set out. So while the McGarrigle family is going through this, and all power to them really, it will help everybody else that's coming behind them in relation to the decisions that they get.
So I guess the message is, it's a lot of work,
yep.
That we're in the very early stages of the scheme, which in theory will continue for a couple of hundred years or until they're robots that sort of do all this thing. Driverless vehicles and all that sort of stuff. So it's important to, if you think something's not fair or something's not in accordance with the NDIS Act, yep. You need to speak up and appeal it.
Yeah, absolutely. So if people look at that fact sheet that we were talking about at the start, which has three different levels of it, and if that works for you and if that's the decision you get, great. But if it's not, and if you think that there's something that you should be receiving more, then you've got options to ask for that decision to be reviewed.
And it might be a long fight, but it's worth having because it will set the foundation for people that will follow.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Chris. It's been really helpful.
Oh, thanks, George. I know it was a long way around, but there's some really interesting things happening in this area, so keep an eye on it.
Thanks.
Thanks, mate.
And that's all we have time for on today's podcast of Reasonable and Necessary, brought to you by the Summer Foundation. Follow us on Facebook at Building Better Lives. You'll be able to access a transcript there and also keep up to date with our latest info on the NDIS. Well, sadly, this is our final podcast in this series. However, keep your eyes on our Facebook page for Series 2 coming to you shortly. I'm Dr. George. Until next time, stay well and reasonable.